Hello.
Hey, Jason.
Hey, what's going on? Is this Andy?
Yeah, it's Andy Tyler. How you doing?
I'm doing well, man. How are you?
I'm good. I'm coming back home or headed back home after a little mini vacation. So.
All right. So you're driving while doing this.
Yeah. Yeah. That's part of the thing. I mean, I live in Los Angeles. So I have a lot of time on the road, a lot of commute, and I listen to a ton of podcasts, and I was like, you know what would be fun is doing my own podcast instead of listening to one. And, you know, nobody was covering this music. Nobody seemed to be, like, talking about it. You know, in pop culture, it seems like the 90s are back, and the 90s are big right now. You can see it in fashion.
Yeah.
You can hear it in a lot of music, in the movies. There's even a movie out called Mid-90s.
Right,
you know,
about the skateboard scene there in L.A., right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think there are three movies coming out about skating, like this year. And,
wow. Okay.
And this music and skating definitely go hand in hand too, or, you know, a lot
for
of it
sure.
Did it in Northern Virginia and in the 90s and in suburbia.
Definitely.
But I was disappointed how so many of the great bands that I grew up listening to and being influenced by, and I know that so many people around me were influenced by the people that they were jamming with and the people that they knew that were forming bands, sometimes even more than the people that they were listening to, you know, on the radio or on CD.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree wholeheartedly with that. And, I mean, even so, like, I think the title of your show is awesome, by the way. The Jams for Man, Jam for Man, I mean, that was pinnacle to how I got into music or even wanted to start a band or, I mean, just to tell you, I mean, the Jam for Man, one of the Jam for Man that I went to, like, had a veil in it, and I remember walking in the door. That was my first, like, if you want to call it underground hardcore punk rock show. I mean, that was my introduction. I mean, I walked in the door, and the band is sitting there. I mean, I didn't know that at the time, but the band is sitting there at the merch table, and they're, you know, doing their thing, like, you know, had their records out, and I was just like, oh, that's cool, like, this, you know, the band's here to, they have a table, and but I didn't know it was a band, of course, but, like, then seeing, you know, them get on stage, I was like, whoa, those were the same guys at the merch table, like, they're just doing this, like, it's just that whole concept of the, you know, do-it-yourself, like, DIY, like, that night, I was like, what, this is blowing my mind, and then just, like, that they're regular people. They walked off stage and were just, like, walking around. I was like, that's crazy. Like, they're so accessible, you know? Like, and then, yeah. So, I mean, I think that point on, I just started going to more shows. And, you know, a lot of my friends started their own bands. I mean, I listened to the Rashad episode that you did, and it is just so awesome because, I mean, it brought back so many memories. And, I mean, I grew up in elementary school. Matt Park was in my, I think he was in my fifth grade or he was in my sixth grade class. But, I mean, we were friends, like, and I think seeing him get into music, because he was the first person I ever knew that had a bass. And I was like, what? Like, you're going to try to play that thing? Like, it's, like, twice as big as you, you know? Like, you know, and then he became, you know, really good. And then you know, meeting Rashad and them starting a band, you know, Olive Juice. And I remember going to see them at Bender's, and I was like, whoa, these are like my peers. These are my friends. These are the kids I go to school with, and they're just up here doing it. And like, and it's rad, you know. And I mean, I can get more into that later, but I mean, like, I mean, one of those bands that was playing with them was a band called Killer Disco Punks. And that had, now we're talking, these are all like middle school, maybe ninth grade kids. So, I mean, that it's just like Josh Neal, who was in Bubble Jug and Kidskin Conduction, he was playing drums for Killer Disco Punks. And so, and Dave Cleary was the singer, and I was like, I know these people. Like, I mean, I went to elementary school with Josh too, and I was like, this is amazing. This, like, I have to see how I can do this. Like, I have to start a band. Like, you know, it sparked it, you know, for me to be like, wow, I could do this too. I mean, I play guitar.
So did you have your own kit at home too?
So I started out just playing like snare drum in the symphonic band, and I guess probably in seventh grade I convinced my parents that an actual drum set would be a beneficial addition to the household, and they agreed. And
for you,
yes. So yeah, my parents went out and they, I think it was for Christmas that year, they bought me a pretty junky Remo drum set that I loved and just started bashing on and, you know, playing punk and metal songs that I was all into at the time. And
which bands were you listening to?
So at that age, it was a lot of Iron Maiden and Anthrax and Motley Crue and you name it, all the sort of edgier metal bands at the time, Metallica, Slayer.
This seems to be a running theme on this show for sure.
Right. But yeah, I mean, it was hot stuff back then. I mean, I honestly still listen to some of the, those bands. I'll pull out some Iron Maiden here and there, but
Anthrax was the first show I ever went to without my parents.
Was it really? I saw that was also my first show, Anthrax and Iron Maiden.
Mine was Anthrax, Primus, and Public Enemy.
Awesome.
Yeah, in D.C.
Yeah, I remember that show. That's amazing. Anthrax and Public Enemy.
Yep, it was a good one. It was a good one. Albeit, I was a little bit more on the Public Enemy side.
Right.
At that point. And when I left the show, I think I was more a fan of Primus than anything.
Right.
I mean, they were like, you know, I saw Primus ever. And I was like, what the fuck just happened?
Right. Yeah, they were pretty groundbreaking when they came out.
Yeah, I'd never seen anything like that. So, who around you were playing instruments at the same time, and who did you first get a chance to jam with or start bands with?
So I grew up in a neighborhood, and my neighbors were actually Jason Capps. Even back then, I knew Jason. And Matt Park, who I played with in future bands as an adult, were both, you know, musicians in the neighborhood who played guitar. We would all get together and, you know, jam out to different metal songs. Sort of a rotating cast, nothing real serious, just more of a get together and try to see what we can do.
Well, that's awesome. And Matt continues to make music.
He does.
Today.
Yeah.
In Germany.
Yep. Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
And you got, you know, you guys were the building blocks of like three or four like awesome bands.
Right.
Basically right there in the neighborhood.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing when I think back to how we all started, you know, playing Megadeth covers in the basement of my house.
So when did you get serious about it? I mean, if you can call it serious.
Yeah, so probably in eighth grade, I shifted and I started to get really into the punk and hardcore music. I discovered Fugazi and, you know, some of the industrial bands, Skinny Puppy, Ministry. So I sort of moved off from the metal into the underground a little bit, and I'm trying to think when we actually started our first real band. But Dave Cleary, one of the singers from Bubble Jug, and myself, and
who just has an insane scream. Like,
yeah.
He just sounds like a maniac.
Right. Undeniable. But we started a band called Killer Disco Punks, KDP, and that was my first real band that actually wrote songs, and we started to actually play some shows. I don't know if you remember a place in Manassas called Vendors.
The Cave.
Yes, exactly. Pre the Cave. Yes. So we would actually we would play there on occasion. You know, our parents would drive us out in the van and hang out while we did these little concerts. And we probably played for maybe 2 years as that band, KDP. And the guitar player started to lose a little bit of interest. And at the same time, you know, I had reconnected with Jason, and Jason had moved into a new neighborhood, and he was a few doors down from Scott Hawkins, who was a bass player, and Jason and Scott were both kind of playing music together, and myself and Dave both still really wanted to play in a band. And we kind of shifted, and KDP sort of morphed into this other band at the time that was unnamed. So we really started to focus on the band with Jason and Scott, Dave and myself, and we played... Gosh, this was probably ninth grade for me, eighth grade for Dave. We played together for a while, and we got introduced to the Kelly Medford, who lived in Herndon.
Now, Jason recalls an additional singer that was with you guys for a little while, I guess.
The first singer that Double Jug had was actually this guy, Bobby Hinstabeck. And he was never on any of the recordings, but he was integral to the band, I think, because we just needed someone who didn't care, like, to scream and experiment and have fun, and he was the guy. Like, but he was also integral because he was friends with Kelly, and Kelly Medford, he was like, hey, guys, like, if we're just going to be experimenting with stuff, like, we should bring my friend Kelly into the band and see what she can kind of add, like, see if two singers kind of work, like. And so Kelly went to, I think at the time she was going to Oakton, I think. But eventually she went to a school in D.C. And then, yeah, so, and then Nate Maddox went to Chantilly as well. So, but yeah, that was all of us. I mean, we pretty much all were in the same area.
Oh my God. Yeah. Okay. So Bobby Hengstenek and I were like really, really good friends all through, like middle school and then into high school. And he was a skater. So I didn't remember that he ever sang for Bubble Jug, but I mean, then it was through him. Okay. But I don't know. Nobody knows what happened to him. I can't find him. What?
Yeah, there are people like that from high school, you know, that just seem to disappear off the map that you would love to find, you know, and you try and try, but they just seem to be, like, gone.
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
I mean, it's like if they're not on Facebook, you don't know where they are.
And they like it that way, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So were you nervous for that tryout? I mean, how do you walk into that situation and just like, you know, do you have any memory of what happened at that tryout?
No, except I knew Scott and obviously Bobby, he was there, but, I don't know. I'm sure I was because I'd never done that before, but I don't remember. I mean, this, I guess because we ended up spending so much time together, they're basically like, even though we don't really talk or anything anymore, they're like, all those guys are family to me. So it's hard to even imagine not being comfortable around them anymore, but I don't remember. I'm sure I was. I'm sure. I'd never done anything like that.
And as a girl just walking into that situation, you had like no hang-ups about being sort of the only girl doing that or the only girl in the band?
No, I totally never felt any of that. It was really nice. They actually needed a girl like to balance everything out, you know. Yeah. And I always imagined that what I was, like, the balancing element, being the only girl. But I never felt like, I don't know, we always just felt like family.
I think musically that's absolutely true, that, you know, you provide a certain energy Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, the Pixies or Sonic Youth, you know, you can't imagine them without that female energy, and it takes kind of a special kind of woman to be in that situation and balance things out for the rest of the dudes in that band. You know, you can't imagine Sonic Youth without Kim Gordon.
Yeah, no, it wouldn't be Sonic Youth, obviously. Yeah. No, I was always totally comfortable, and I was very, outspoken, outgoing, and I never felt uncomfortable, ever.
Now, did you bring those diaries? Is that where you were getting your lyrics from? I mean, what were you doing in order to pull lyrics out?
I think I would just sort of make them up on the spot that seemed to somehow fit the energy of the song in my mind. Now if I listen to it, so embarrassing. Like, it's total teenage angst, but, But I think mostly you're just, because I always kept diaries. So, yeah, I could read through things from them, but mostly it would just be things written, when they were sort of composing the song. So words that would just come based on sort of the energy and the feeling of music.
Do you remember any songs that just seemed to come together, like, out of nowhere? Like, they just happened, like, it was destined to happen that way?
Because I wasn't a musician, so for me, they all kind of were like that. But I think probably Tom, for sure. And then, I don't know what others, but Tom just immediately comes to mind.
To be crazy noisy, like, I mean, that's it, experimenting with sound. But I think, like, I mean, yeah, I don't know if we were really conscious of, like, the Sonic Youth influence in the beginning. Especially, I mean, I don't know that any of us were, like, heavy into them yet, but I think just because Kelly, I mean, she was always, like, so cool, because she, like, she'd already been in, she'd gone to so many shows in D.C. already. I mean, at that time when we were forming, I don't even know that I had been to a show, like, at the 930 or Black Cat yet. I mean, I had no exposure to any of that at all. I knew it existed, but it seemed still really foreign. Like, I had no concept of, like, how those bands even get to play there. But she was already, like, going to those shows, and so she was really highly influenced by, like, I mean, some of the like Riot Girl bands of that time, you know. I mean, we're talking like Bikini Kill and I'm like going completely blank on a lot of that era kind of music, but you know, just some of the stuff that was coming off of like Kill Rock Stars.
Oh, I don't think it was any one band. I mean, there were just, you know, it's like you don't realize until hindsight, but there were so many good bands. I mean, and the thing was, they weren't famous people, so you ended up becoming friends with everyone. I mean, I loved Born Against so much. Like, they were probably one of my favorite bands. And I loved Bikini Kill and UOA, Universal Order of Armageddon, and we all became friends, and then, you know, different people played in different people's bands, so it was all sort of incestuous. So it was probably the fact that it was kind of a small, close-knit community, and that we all kind of became friends anyway, but I remember just really, I loved Born Against so much.
Yeah, I'm a dead, I'm a dying. With the dog, I'm a dead, I'm a dying.
wanted the first one of us to be able to drive anywhere. And so, like, she would go pick, you know, us up for practice or something like that, and she'd be playing this music in her car. And I'm like, wow, this is really cool. I've never heard some girl just screaming her head off, like, in such a cool way, too, you know? And, like, and so I think that was more of our influence. I mean, even so much so that I think, like, those first, like, basement shows that Bubble Jug did, I mean, we would cover, like, I don't know, Heavens to Betsy or, like, some Bikini Kill stuff. I mean, just because that was what Kelly was familiar with, too, you know, or that we could easily all play together. And then I think, like, when we started formulating our own music and thoughts on what that music should be, that's when, I mean, we would all go into, you know, I think our music vocabulary expanded because we were listening to more music and we were more exposed to bands in our area, DC, Maryland. And we're like, whoa, like, there's some crazy stuff going on right now. And these bands are, like, sonically, like, really heavy. Like, how do we even, like, how do we interpret that? Like, how do we, like, take our spin on that? And, you know, to be honest with you, Andy, like, I don't know how that organically happened. I think we locked ourselves in a basement, in Josh's basement. We played shows every once in a while, but, like, I was, like, I think that summer of, like, 9th, 10th grade, we just, like, hammered it out in the basement. And we added Nate, who, like, played sax and trumpet and trombone. And we added, I mean, we added a third singer. We had Dave. So we had, like, three singers. And so we could, like, sonically pick who was going to sing what part and who was appropriate for what part and just try it out. And, like, I don't know if we were all thinking about it on that level, but I think that's kind of what was just happening. And, yeah, I don't know. But, like, yeah, Sonic Youth, I think you nailed it. But I don't think we were listening to Sonic Youth till a little bit later. So
what? How would songs start? Would it start with a drum beat? Would it start with a guitar riff? Was there somebody that would... tended to come in with stuff demoed or partially done? Like, remember of, like, the songwriting process?
All right. Well, I think it, like, most of the songs, to be honest with you, would start off with either a bass part, and Josh and Scott were really good. And so I should back up and say, well, at one point, Bobby left the band. And so then it was able us to kind of, you know, we had two singers. Nate eventually started singing as well, but that wasn't until a lot later when we started getting maybe a little bit more, like, I guess sonically more, I don't know, faster and heavier. And, like, his horns, like, he could put those down and just start screaming. But, okay, so the songwriting process, it would start off with either, like, Josh and Scott. I mean, we were highly influenced by, like, bands that were heavy bass and drums anyway, and that wasn't very hard because that whole 90s, like, if you look at anything on Discord, I mean, it's all rhythmic, right? So it's like, you know, we were looking up to bands like Fugazi and Jawbox and I think, you know, I'm trying to think of some other bands that we were really kind of into at that time. And I think even, like, Chicago, Josh really kind of turned me on to, like, Jesus Lizard and, you know, Tar and stuff like that. And then, I mean, I think that's the songs we started kind of trying to model that. We're like, okay, like, let's at least just get the rhythm down, like, you know. And then, or I might introduce a guitar part, but my guitar parts, I never wanted to really think of it as, like, here's a riff, guys. It was like, I'm going to try to make something rhythmic on my guitar to be an accent to what the drums and bass are doing. So, that's kind of it. Like, we were just like, someone would come in with, like, a guitar or bass part. Josh was this crazy, amazing drummer. I mean, you listen to the Bubble Jug. I mean, I listen to the Bubble Jug stuff now, and I'm like, that kid is an animal. And, I mean, like, you know, he was only, when we recorded that first split with Vest Pocket Psalm, I mean, Josh, we were only like maybe 15, 16. I mean, he's just a beast. Like, it was really awesome. And so he could do anything. Like, and he was just super creative. Him and Scott would come up with something really cool and like, and I would just add to it. And then Kelly and Dave, I don't know their whole process, and maybe you can interview them to figure it out, because I could never figure out. They were just so good at just trying. Like, we would be playing something over and over and over again, and they would just try. They would just try to add lyrics to it, and then they'd go back to the pen and just write for a while, and then, like, come back and try to add more, and, like, it just happened organically like that. We had nothing planned out. Nothing was like, hey, guys, it's going to be this, you know, this measure for, you know, we're going to count to this. We're going to do that. You know, here's a recorded part that you can help us out. Like, nothing. Nothing was planned. Total chaos.
But, like, a certain organized chaos, and it worked.
Totally.
It worked. And it has so much youthful energy in it. You can hear it.
I think you nailed it right there. I mean, we're just kids. Like, I mean, when we started Bubble Jug, I mean, I don't, like I said, not hardly any of us could even drive. So, yeah, I think that was it, man. It was just youthful energy.
Open to wherever the group wanted to go. And I mean, that, I think, you know, when Nate came onto the scene, Nate Maddox, the other singer and the, you know, the horn player and drummer, it was a
multi-instrumentalist.
I'm sorry?
I was just saying multi-instrumentalist.
Right. And really, that was almost the whole band.
It was a nitrogen tank.
Right, exactly. But when he came on to the scene with us and started, you know, coming to our practices and just slowly started to, you know, make music with us. Again, it was very sort of, it just happened. There wasn't any sort of big discussion about, do we add another member? You know, is this where we want to go? It was just sort of, let's roll with it and do what feels good. And it, you know, worked really well for all of us. It was really very, trying to think of the right word to describe the time there. I mean, it was an evolution, a natural evolution, I guess was how I would put it. It, there was never sort of a concerted effort to move in a certain direction with any of it. It just kind of came on its own.
So how did you guys, like, what was your first show? You remember that even?
I'm trying to think. So I know, you know, very early on, we did a lot of shows in Kelly's basement, you know, just house shows with local bands. Gosh, you know, I want to say probably the first real show out at a venue was at the Mountain Lodge in Georgetown. I don't know if you remember that coffee shop sort of facility right there across the Key Bridge.
Yeah, right there on M Street.
Yep. Yeah, so that was probably our first real concert. And to frame it, at that point, we were still having to have our parents drive us to these shows because none of us had driver's licenses.
Well,
must
be playing D.C.
Oh, yeah, it was awesome. We had all gone to see a few shows there already, other punk bands, so this was like a really big deal for us. And, you know, playing in the city was quite a change from a little basement show.
I mean, you know, Lugnut knew Kelly, so they were like, hey, like, can we, you know, play some shows with you? And, I mean, we played, like, all over with them. I mean, we played basements. We played, I think we played a couple shows. So did you ever go to that place called the Music Store? Yeah, like, it was totally crazy. It was this weird place back in the industrial section. And to be honest with you, I don't even know how we got a lead to go play there. But it was run by, this guy was so awesome. It's a guy named Johnny Ray. And he ran it, like, the front of the place was a music store, but he just had, like, I mean, it was so sparse, like, you know, like a couple of guitars in there and like maybe a bass and I don't know. It was just like a couple packs of strings. And I mean, it was not really a music store, but the whole back end of it was this big like warehouse. And, like once we found out about that, we're like, this is it. This is our Chantilly, like St. Stephen's. this is where all the shows are going to go down. Because it was, like, so massive. The guy, Johnny, like, he could care less, like, what kids did there as long as he, you know, got paid. And, I mean, so, like, I remember, maybe the first couple of Bubble Jug shows, it was, like, maybe, I would say we would be lucky to get, like, I don't know, like, 50, 70 kids in there, maybe. But then, like, it started growing, and I remember I heard, like, I was down at Record Convergence, and I saw, like, that Frotus was playing there. And I was like, whoa, how did they find out about it? And we just seen Frotus. Like, and I had no idea. And, and I was almost about to pass on the show, to be honest with you, but I was telling a guy that I worked with, I was like, hey, like, yeah, like, I don't know, Saturday night, I'm going to check out Frotus, this band Frotus. And he's like, oh, Frotus, I know, Shelby. And I was like, what? And he's like, yeah, I go to high school with Shelby. He's really cool. I think you'll like them. I was like, what? Okay, I'll go check them out. I was like, do you even know what kind of music it is? He's like, I have no idea. He's like, they're just cool. Go check them out. So I went and checked them out, and I was like, oh, my gosh, like, these guys are amazing. Like, what the hey? Like, what am I? Like, I had never even heard of them. And they're, like, just in the next town over, essentially. Like,
and what time signature are they playing in? Like,
right. Well, and this was, like, the Babe era, right? And so they had, like, I forget that first bass player's name, but, like, I was like, what the hell is going on? Like, they are amazing. And then they had, like, a saxophone player come out and play with them on one song. I forget. It was, like, maybe the computer song. I don't even know. But, like, I went up to them after the show, and I was just like, hey, like, you know, hey, we have a saxophonist in our band, too, or something. I was like, you guys are cool. Like, can we play with you here? And that show, like, is what is recorded on, I don't know, someone posted the discography, the Bubble Jug discography, a couple places, but, you know, on YouTube. like the live show that is on that recording is from that night that we played with them. And it's hilarious because, like, we probably got, like, 200-300 kids into the music store. I mean, because it was, like, our friends, their friends from, like, you know, Springfield and Fairfax and, like, I mean, just totally rad. And, like, then, you know, I just... That was the spark for everything else, too, because then we started playing, like, I mean, playing at Record Convergence. And then, like, I don't know that we played anywhere. Maybe we played, I want to say, maybe someplace in Arlington or something with Sodas. But, I mean, we just, you know, walking up to someone and just being like, you know, and I think you nailed it. I think it was the Rashad episode again, is that Record Convergence was kind of the hub. You know, it was like, all right, we got our local record store. I'm looking at the flyers. Who's playing? Where are they playing? Like, cool, rad. Like, I want to play with those bands. How do I play it where they're playing? You know, that kind of stuff. And it was all accessible because you could just, you know, I don't know, call them or walk up to them or something like that, you know? So, I don't know. It was just a neat time, really.
The music store. Yeah, we had so many. We had a couple. Like, I remember the guy that ran it was like totally crazy. Maybe he was a heroin addict. I don't remember, but he was really crazy. But that was actually a great stage because it had that stage and it was like a big open room, run by the crazy guy. What was his name? His name's Johnny. And then obviously the last show we played, that was like heartbreaking. And then, yeah, we played that, at least once we played that great place that was like a cafe on the corner of M Street, like right before you get to the bridge. I think Georgetown was a shithole still, once upon a time. And somehow we managed to play the Black Cat even though we weren't 18. They let us play in the small room once. And then we played a show in Baltimore once that was, like, really fun. But seriously, we actually played a lot of shows. They were all so much fun.
Who were your audience for the most part at those shows? Do you remember, like, looking out and, you know, Who did you see out there?
Yeah, I mean, mostly our friends, like especially at first. And it kind of depended on who we were playing with and where we were playing. But, you know, a lot of high school kids. We played in DuPont, actually, once. We played with the QD show? I can't remember. But, and then depending on the show, there would just be, you know, people from the local scene in D.C. That weren't in high school anymore. We're, like, a little bit older. There was this great cooperative. I think it was called The Hive, or The Beehive, or something like that. They actually organized a lot of stuff. They organized student bombs, and Bikini Kill was really active with them. And so a lot of those kinds of, you know, punk people from around D.C. that were just really active, both in the music scene and sort of active in general in the city.
So if you heard the Rashad episode, then you know my obsession with the gum, bubble gum.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd give like $1,000 right now for an actual bubble jug.
You are in luck. No, I don't have any bubble jug. But
if you had one, it'd also be 25 years old.
It's so funny, man. I mean, I heard your comments about that, and I laughed so hard because I don't know why. I've always been kind of I don't know. I'm not ashamed of the name, but I feel like it was my doing, and I don't know. It's kind of a silly name, but at the same time, it just, again, it's back to, you know, us just being young and silly. And, I mean, so the first show, how the Bubble Jug name came about. Now, I would love to hear the other people's, I guess, perspective, but I believe this
will
be true, is that, yeah, so we were playing a show, and it was the first Bubble Jug show ever. It was at a kid's house, and we didn't have a name. And I remember the kid putting on the show just kept, you know, asking. He's like, what's your guys' name? You need to come up with a name. I'm making the flyer. And we had just, I believe it was like either during practice, because I don't think it was right before this show, because, I mean, he couldn't have made a flyer. But I had, like you, I was obsessed with Bubble Jug. And I think when that gum came out, I constantly carried around one with me because I just thought it was so crazy, and I would make everyone try it. I'm like, come on, just put it in your mouth. It's nuts. And, so I had that, like, sitting on top of my amp, and we couldn't decide on a name, and no one could even, like, I don't even think we could even put one out. We were just like, what? I don't know, a name? We haven't even gotten that far. And I was like, yeah, you know what? Bubble Jug. And he looked at it, he was like, I just remember, you know, being like, what? I'm like, yeah, Bubble Jug. And they're like, yeah, that's great, just like the gum. And so it stuck with us. It stuck with us forever. So,
yeah
well, that's it, man.
It's a good thing you weren't into Big League 2.
Who knows, it might have been better. I don't know. Or we could have had a lawsuit on our hands. I'm not quite sure. But, Yeah.
Were you more of a classic pink or the tropical green?
Oh, no, I couldn't take the tropical green. It was the pink for sure. Like, yeah, I don't know. I just, that stuff was pretty, I mean, all of it was gnarly when I think back on it. I'm like, oh my gosh, this stuff is disgusting. But I think the pink at least tasted the most classic. So I think I could...
My buddy Dan, we used to drive to like Toys R Us in Tyson, and we would get like, you know, we would get like six packs of Bubble Jug. You know, we would get like, we would just buy a ton of it, and then we would see how much we could take down, and he just used to push me to try to like take down a whole Bubble Jug in my mouth at like one time.
Oh, I couldn't imagine.
And
it's like the equivalent of like I don't know, whatever, like the saltine challenge now or whatever it is. You know,
like,
it's like,
or like drinking
a
gallon of milk at once.
Yeah.
Because people don't understand that it was all like powder too. So it took a little while, like once it hit your saliva, to turn into gum. But, like, when you're just drinking it out of the bottle, you're just putting this giant amount of this crazy powder in your mouth.
Totally. I wonder if they, like, completely took it off the market only because, I mean, if someone had to choke on that, it's like, that stuff is disgusting.
I loved it. That was funny. I miss it so bad. It's funny, when I was looking up Bubble Jug stuff, trying to get, like, more information on the band.
You got gum.
I get all these gum sites, too. Like, it's kind of hard to look you guys up without getting, inundated with all of this Bubble Jug stuff. And then it's hard to concentrate, because I'm like, ooh, that Bubble Jug shirt is incredible. Like, I got to get one of those.
Oh, man. Why we didn't think of that? We could have made, like, T-shirts with the actual image. I don't know. But, yeah, that is too funny, and I'm sorry.
So the name Bubble Jug obviously is in reference to the candy gum. There's a little bit of a story behind it. We had gotten snowed in at my cousin's house. He lived out in Casanova, Virginia, Christian Quick, pretty prominent recording engineer in the area for many years. But we had gotten snowed in and we weren't able to leave the house there for several days, and we eventually ventured out. And
all you had to eat was bubble jug to survive.
Not quite that interesting. It's actually probably not that interesting of a story, telling it in retrospect. But we, after having been locked in the house for multiple days, we made it out to the market and found this thing called bubble jug, and we were just so amused at the concept of this powdered gum in a jug that we all bought some and just continually joked about it to the point where we said we should name our band Bubble Jug. And we did.
I worship at the altar of the gum.
Well, I think what we all liked is the name seemed so sort of innocent and not reflective of the music we were playing, right? It's sort of misleading when you hear Bubble Jug and then you hear the screams coming from Dave and Kelly and the intensity of the music we were trying to play.
Yeah, there's also the fact that, you know, a jug was an odd instrument that people would incorporate into their band.
Sure.
Like jug band.
Yep.
I grew up on Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas and had a certain fascination with the jug as an instrument. And you guys definitely had, like, all of these weird instruments that you would incorporate. I mean, maybe not weird, but, well, I guess a nitrous tank is weird as an instrument. But,
right.
You had a lot of eclectic instruments for a punk band, for the kind of band that you guys played in.
The nitrous tank was certainly an infamous part of the kit. At one point, we tried to bring an old empty beer keg as a percussion instrument, and that quickly got nixed because of, A, the logistics of trying to drive a keg around, and then, B, having a keg and being 16-year-old kids driving late at night in the city. So,
that's an old joke about Tom Waits. When he said bring the fender, he really means the fucking fender of the truck.
Right. Which makes a good, pretty good percussion instrument if you can pull it off.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about. So you guys had the name. And I didn't realize that Christian was your cousin.
Yes.
That is convenient that your cousin owns his own recording studio.
Quite convenient. So I actually, in parallel to Bubble Jug, I played a lot of music with Christian and my other cousins. And that's, you know, you could say that's sort of where Christian learned the trade of, you know, record engineering was recording stuff in the house that we were just jamming as another band.
Now, did Christian ever have his own band?
Yes. So I played in a band with Christian and Christian's brother, Jason. We were called Chrome Yellow originally, and then we changed the name to Malloy. And he led that band for, gosh, probably close to 10 years. I played drums in it for quite a while, and then there were a couple other drummers who rotated through. But yeah, he played, you know, quite a bit, number of shows, couple albums. So it was quite convenient having a close cousin who was quickly becoming a top-notch engineer. So that definitely made it easier for Bubble Jug and the band to start to record our music.
I love so many of the bands that he recorded, and so
that's amazing
stuff that he did. You know, I mean,
yep.
He's responsible for recording you guys and Kitskin and Lugnut and of course Ugly.
Yep, Jarhead,
Shoutbust. Like, there's a lot of great stuff.
Yep. He was quite prolific, and you know, I appreciated his approach of, you know, not having a cookie cutter recording methodology. He really sort of crafted unique sounds for each of the bands.
Yes. Awesome. It seems like Christian and Don Zientara, between the two of them, you know, it's pretty much they've recorded everybody.
Right. Yep. Yeah, if you weren't recording with one, you were using the other.
but you guys actually have another demo that it doesn't sound like it was recorded by Christian at all.
It's much
heavier and very streamlined.
Yeah, so we actually, the first real recording we did, the cassette demo, so Christian had just recently started to set up his studio at Drum and Strum in Warrington, and we went there and did an evening directed DAT recording, basically, where we just played live, tracked it, you know, song by song. He actually did all of our recordings, both the demo, the two records we released on vinyl, and then we had some live recordings we did that he also did for us. But he was our guy.
They sound like two totally different, you know, styles of recording for sure.
Right. Yep. Yeah. The demo was definitely a lot more raw and streamlined, and, you know, immature is not the right word, but you know, that was really our first taste of doing any type of work in the studio outside of the stuff I had done with Christian previously in our own band. So it was a formative moment for Bubble Jug.
Were there any songs on that demo that you were excited about when you first heard them, raw as they may have been?
At the time it was amazing from top to bottom, just getting to hear how all that music sounded with the mics and, you know, the bit of fine tuning and magic that Christian pulled off. It was, yeah, I mean, it's funny to think about it. You know, we were 15-year-old kids making a record and playing these shows. Yeah, it was pretty hard to comprehend at this point in my life where we were back then.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it, though.
Yeah, I try to tell my kids about my childhood, and they're not quite at the age where they get it yet, but definitely a pretty magical time.
any recollections of recording any of the music, or what you felt like when you first, you know, heard your own recordings back to yourself?
Oh my God, hearing your own voice being recorded is just horrible. But no, recording was, oh my God, I mean, those were like the best, I think those are my favorite times with Bubble Jug, is recording with Christian, because we would be staying down, you know, with Josh's cousins in the countryside. Oh man, those were really, really fun sessions. We would just stay up all night, and Christian is really good at what he, you know, at recording. And no, it was amazing, because in some of the recording team, we added string instruments, and no, it was so exciting to actually, you know, put songs, how do you, like, to make them, to record them so they're, you know, there forever. And you can't really hear anything when you're playing, you know, at a show or in a basement. So it's amazing to hear it. It's like it becomes crystal clear, sort of.
Yeah, and it really expanded your sound. I mean, you guys, you use a lot of, you know, there are a lot of, like, samples on there.
Yeah.
You know, just, like, random, I don't know, like, from movies, there's, like, the pig sounds on that one song.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden there are strings where it's like, since when did Bubble Jug have strings?
Yeah, no, it was, like, really nice to be able to add that stuff. So nice. And, I mean, because then it's, like, you know, it's a difference. I mean, I'm an artist, so it's, like, the difference between a sketch and, like, a finished painting that you really can spend more time working with, you know, and develop into something else. So we're so lucky to have the opportunity to do that.
It was cool. Like, it was way more relaxed because we all knew Christian, too. Christian would either come up and hang out with us, go to shows, or just be, like, hanging out with Josh, or we would go down to Warrington to, like, his house. But, yeah, it was, like, way more relaxed. And, yeah, it was just really kind of – I'm trying to think back to the recording. But, yeah, all of it was done with Christian.
Did you use your own gear, or did you use any of Christian's gear?
I think, honestly, well, so for the first split with Vest Pocket Tom, I did bring down my head, and I brought my guitar. Yeah, just one of them. But I then, like, on the second recording, which is the pretty much the Kidskin split, that was going straight. I don't know if Christian had me going straight through the board. I don't know what he did, but my sound on that thing is crazy, and I loved it because it just sounded so fuzzed out, like, which is not something I would normally go for live even, but it just sounded so crazy, distorted, and rad. But, yeah, I think on that one I went straight through the board, or he had me going into a head that he provided. But I played my guitar on all that stuff.
Do you have any favorite tracks from Bubble Jug?
Oh, man. You know, I don't know. It's a hard one. I think, because, like, talking either playing live or what I was happy with the recording, it's just, like, I always felt like Bubble Jug was kind of, like, I don't know, it was, like, hard, it was hard for us to capture the live sound on record. I mean, Christian did a great job, and I'm happy with it, and there were things on the record that I was, like, really blown away, because we had someone come in, like, Christian, nudist celloist, who, like, added a huge dynamic to the first recordings. I mean, if you hear any of that, those early recordings, like, that, all those, like, swelling sounds in the back and, like, the more atmospheric stuff, that's all that cello player, and it just sounds rad. But I think, out of all, just the song that I'm happiest with of everything that I can listen to is Nothing For Now, which is the song that Kelly sings on. And it's just, like, really, I don't know, sweet sounding, which is not what we sounded like. If those are, that's the one song that doesn't sound like Bubble Jug. but I mean, out of our sound, there's a song called Continuation. And again, I think that song recorded live, is the closest to a live sound that you will hear on the records, because, I mean, it was so awesome that that's the song that's got all the percussion in the back, and it's all of us playing, and it's just a, I don't know, it just sounds more like Bubble Jug to me. So, yeah, I like that song probably the most.
We got
This is a pretty funny story, and but when we got the art for the Vest Pocket Psalm, the album, the split, and they had on their side. So it, for the people listening, so and if you haven't seen it, the record cover was just a folded like paper bag. It was really nice, and it was just folded nicely. And on the Vest Pocket Psalm side, they went and got really nice printed album art, and they pasted it to the side, and it looks really, I mean, it looks good. I mean, that's kind of what people were doing back in the 90s. Like, if you look at some of the stuff that were coming out of, like, Old Glory Records, or I'm trying to think of bands that were doing that at the time, you know, it was like they had these, just to cut down on cost. You would get like 500 to 1,000 paper bags and big grocery bags, and you would fold them down, and that would be a record sleeve. And so, or the record cover. But so on our side, I mean, again, kind of being kids and just being really dumb, and we dropped the ball, I think, because we didn't realize that we were supposed to come up with our own art. And so when the records, like, we had to go pick up the record.
Even though you had an artist, a visual artist in the band?
I think that would be Josh and Nate. And it's funny because, like, later on in life, that's kind of where I got my start is in graphic design. But, like, I mean, at the time, we were just like, oh, my gosh. Like, so the actual zine that you see on the inside, Josh, like, I think everyone but me, just because I was just like, you guys do it. And plus they're so creative. Like, Josh and Nate and Kelly and all of them, like, they just put together this really cool zine for the inside. But the album, the outside, we didn't really plan for. And so we didn't even know how that was going to work. And so we go pick up the records from Nervous Wreckage, and we realize that there's no, like, other side. And so we were like, oh, gosh, like, I guess. And they were like, yeah, you need to come up some album art and put it on that. But you got to do it fast because we need to start selling these things. And so, like, especially at your shows and whatever. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. And so we're all sitting around, and we decided to, like, come up. We cut a stencil that just had Bubble Jug, the name Bubble Jug. And we put those in the upper, I believe it's in the upper left corner. But the rest of the album, we just took whatever spray paint's available, and we just, like, we just freeformed, like, using spray paint on 500 album covers. I mean, there was, like, so each one is different. And I think when Nervous Records saw that, they flipped out. They're like, you know, what are you doing? Like, that's crazy. Like, you know, we meant for you guys to do something professional. This is insane. And but I think it makes it unique because each album cover was that. It was unique. And I think people are like, oh, I got the one that has, like, a dot pattern going this way. I got one that has an arrow on it. You know, each one was kind of funny, or we just thought we were being funny. And, I don't know. So you see those pop up on eBay. But, I mean, back to even just our music being available online to listen to, it blows me away, like, that even has happened. Like, I don't know. And that people talk about it. And kids from nowadays and all around the world, you know, I mean, I'm like, what? How did you even hear from us or hear about our music? But I think it's because of the bands that we're associated with, and I think it's the bands we played with. You know, if you look up, like, I don't know. Well, I mean, even like Frotus, right? That we played a bunch of shows with Frotus, and I mean, they've got their whole, like, I think every show they've ever played posted online and who they played with.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that way, but I mean, like, yeah, just even looking up, like, I mean, like, Avail, and you'll see, like, you know, our flyer with them and Iconoclast and, you know, us playing with Antioch Arrow from San Diego, or and then people listen to that and they're like, wow, like, I like Antioch Arrow. Maybe I'll like Bubble Jug. Maybe that's how they're finding it. I have no idea, but it does blow my mind because I'm like, where are these people? How are they hearing about it?
What exactly, like, happened with the band towards the end? Did you guys just all go to college? I mean,
we graduated high school, so it seemed like the natural sort of end of things. It's actually a good lesson to let a good thing go, you know, and not let it fade out into its slow death.
Did you miss it? Did you consider starting like another band in college? I mean,
no, because nobody ever asked me, and it never occurred to me. Like in college, I went to a really small college. We had a big student space, and we would just have huge parties. So I love DJing those parties, and I love DJing. And yeah, now I play music with friends and like with two other women. We're kind of in like a girl band, but I really have a eclectic taste in music, so I kind of find it hard to find people I'm, I guess, compatible with musically. And I'm not very good either. I mean, I started teaching myself ukulele maybe like, I don't know, a year or two ago, just because I thought I worked too much and so I needed to do something else that wasn't just working all the time. So just for fun. And then I tried to start like a girl band, but haven't been very successful.
I think this is pretty natural. Like all of us were going off to college. Kelly went to school in Ohio. I went out to New Mexico, and Scott went to Old Dominion, and Josh and Dave, they still were playing music. I mean, Dave, I think he might have, he at least recorded one song with Kid Skin Conduction, which is amazing. I wish I could find that track because it's so good. But it was like on this demo that they sent me while I was out in New Mexico, like my first like couple months here. And I was like, what are you guys doing? This sounds awesome. Like, I mean, I was almost like this proud papa moment. Like anytime I would hear anything from Kid Skin, I was like, oh my gosh, like my boys are doing so well, you know, like, I don't know. So, what else? I mean, I think that's just what happened. Nate was kind of traveling around. It was just kind of a natural thing. We talked at least about getting together and playing like a small tour the summer after we broke up from high school, but it just never happened because just life, you know. But yeah.
What other bands were the members involved with or went on to play in?
Okay, right. Yeah, sorry, I was my head was going in a totally different direction there.
Oh
so.
No. In the family tree is also all the bands that you played with, too.
Right.
It's gigantic, but that's part of this whole thing.
Sure.
I'm tracking down everybody.
So post-Bubble Jug, you know, I played in Kids in Conduction with Scott, and that was where Matt Park came into our group, and we started to play with him and Rashad Jones as well. Let's see. Scott played with, do you remember a band from Richmond called More Fire for Burning People?
No, but that's awesome.
Yeah, they were an awesome band. Scott ended up playing in a band with the drummer from that band down in Richmond. They were called Ada Doom. Gosh, I'm trying to think. I know there's been a number of other bands. Jason has played with some people out in Albuquerque since he moved there.
What about Dave?
But Dave has not. Dave hasn't played in any band since Bubble Jug. He moved out to Eugene, Oregon for a while after we broke up, and he eventually made his way back to Northern Virginia, but he hasn't played in a serious band since.
Weird, and neither did Kelly. What about Nate?
So Nate, he traveled pretty extensively after Bubble Jug, and he actually landed in New York, and he was playing with Gang Gang Dance, who obviously are a pretty popular group at this point. He played with them for quite a while until he was killed in New York. He was watching a thunderstorm on the roof in Manhattan and got struck by lightning.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So this, gosh, I want to say that was probably 15 years ago at this point.
That's
quite
awesome.
A shock. Yeah. Pretty crazy situation.
Yeah,
most
of the musicians we've lost, it was either, you know, drugs or alcohol, suicide, you know,
right.
Stuff like that.
Well, I'll give Nate credit, you know, the way he went out, that suits him perfectly. Such a crazy situation. So yeah, Nate.
I mean, he certainly survived by, you know, the music that he left behind, which is
absolutely a
good body of work.
Yeah,
it sounds like, you know, Gang Gang Dance are he helped put him on the map.
Yes, in fact, if you go look at the early Gang Gang Dance album covers, they're all based around a picture of Nate.
Hmm.
It's kind of hard to look at sometimes, but.
The summer of 2002, Nathan was, he was in a band called Gang Gang Dance. And I guess they're pretty well known. They're a New York band. He moved to New York City. And he passed away that summer. But yeah, like, we've gotten together, we've talked about, like, wouldn't it be funny, like, for someone's wedding for us to, like, play or something like that, but, I mean, of course that's never happened, but like, I don't know, but yeah, I think.
Well,
we're talking
about having a Jam for Man anniversary show.
That would be amazing.
I'm trying to put it together. So.
Yeah, I heard you trying to, like, get Rashad to do it, and I would say, like, I can't speak for the rest of the band, but I would be so down to do that. It would be really fun. Mainly because I don't know, I think it would just be full circle, right? For me, personally, I don't think Bubble Jug ever played a Jam for Man. And I remember those shows were massive. I mean, I thought so, you know, like being a little kid going in there, like an eighth grader, ninth grader, and just being like, oh my gosh, there's so many people, and they're all, you know, really into, like, yeah, they're really into cool things, and like, what it, like, and I, like, yes, that would be so amazing if that could happen. I would really enjoy that for sure.
So speaking of just sort of like the D.C. and D.C. suburbs, what do you think it was about growing up there that turned out so many great musicians and turned out so many great bands?
I've thought about this, you know, in the past, and I think it was just, the proximity to D.C. And, I mean, you know, knowing that, like, Discord Records is in your backyard, you know, like, or we are the backyard of Discord Records, essentially, and I think that's really, hey, I mean, in trying to, like, wow, like, these people don't live that far from us, like, and they're doing it, and they're making really cool stuff. And not only are they making cool stuff, they've been making cool stuff for ever, you know? So it's like, I don't know. And I mean, and I think, I know, you know, I was like, wow, like Frotis even recorded at Inner Ear, and like, I mean, that's the places that like all the cool records that I was like listening to, that's where they got recorded. And that's just, I don't know, just, yeah, I think being inspired by the stuff around us and the music scene in general was like, you know, there was shows happening everywhere. I mean, in people's, you know, in the burbs, it was happening in people's basements. It's happening in little tiny coffee shops to weird, like, industrial areas. And, I mean, at least for us in Chantilly. And then, you know, you move into, like, Fairfax, and, you know, we had Record Convergence, and they started putting on shows. And then I think there was, like, I forget the name of the coffee place there. Is it called Dharma? I forget. There was a record,
Dharma.
You know. They were putting on shows, and then, you know, you go closer and go, like, Arlington. There was, like, places in Arlington, and not only that, like, there were punk houses, like, everywhere, like, up in Maryland. And so I just think it's just, yeah, the accessibility of the shows, so much going on. I can only speak for myself on this. I think having a band like Avail, who, when I discovered them, they'd already moved to Richmond. Like, but
me
I remember
too,
buying Satiate. Yeah, and like, I bought Satiate that night that I went, so I'm rapping back to the Jam for Man. But that night, I bought Satiate. And
such a good album.
I got home and I was just like, what the fuck? You know, like, this band is now, like, it was just so ingrained in me. I think I listened to that thing like 10 or 12 times a day. Like, and then I found out, like, later on, I'm like, these guys were from Reston? Like, what? Like, they were on, you know, they were, I mean, I just kind of looked up to them and I was just like, wow, like, all these bands, they're small bands, but they're doing so many amazing things. And then you see them grow and they're getting bigger and bigger. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like we could do that. I mean, we can make that happen. I think, like, so yeah, I think that's it. Just, I don't know. I mean, like, you know, I moved out to New Mexico right after high school, and they have, at the time, they had things like that here too, like small punk houses. There were a couple clubs. Oh, I mean, this is another big point. I don't know. Like, you know, in D.C., I remember, you know, being able to get into the shows underage. I mean, you go to 9:30, you go to Black Cat, like, they mark you, and you're in. So, I was going to shows, all of us in Bubble Jug, before we could drive. And, I mean, out here, it's not as accessible. You know, it's usually typically at a bar. It's 21 and older. So, like, kids aren't exposed to that stuff in an easy way. I mean, they get it because there's been amazing bands that come out of New Mexico, but, like, you know, I mean, I think D.C., just the way that shows were put on there, like, it was just, yeah, again, I keep using the word accessible, but that's what it was. It was just so accessible.
Yeah, you know, it was such a magical time. It was just like, you know, there's things that you can never repeat no matter how hard you try. It was just like the right time to be playing music in D.C. It was like, there were so many good bands. There was such a great scene. There was a really cool community of people. Like, I don't think it will ever be repeated again.